month, I think it's too much of a clown. So we've been lucky, but we're not going to be lucky forever, necessarily.
MIT professor Noam Chomsky. To see the full interview, go to democracynow.org. I'll be doing a public interview with Noam Chomsky on Monday, April 24th in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This Friday, April 7th, I'll be speaking in Denver at the Su Teatro Performing Arts Center on Santa Fe Drive. Then on Saturday, April 8th, I'll be speaking in Castlegar, British Columbia in Canada. Check our website for details. Special thanks to Mike Burke and Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Join From the Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary on April 7th, 2017, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. We will continue our musical education by focusing on Sam Cooke. Sam Cooke, his voice was like an angel. Sam Cooke, he lived like an intelligent, proud black man. Sam Cooke, he died like a human being. From the Grassroots, April 7th, from 8 p.m. until 10, on 90.7 FM, KBOO in Portland.
It is 5:01, and we're ready for KBOO Evening News this evening. This program has been brought to you in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. This program has also been made possible by KBOO members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a candidate forum for Portland Public School District Board candidates on Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building, 501 Southeast Hawthorne. This forum is in partnership with Oregon Parent Teacher Association and Communities and Parents for Public Schools. More voter information at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley led a 15-hour filibuster in opposition to Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch last night.
The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled in favor of a woman who was fired for her sexual orientation.
And Oregon Representative Suzanne Bonamici has proposed a bill that would ban ICE agents from all courthouses.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Yesterday, the full Senate began debate around the nomination of Colorado Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. Senate Democrats are still seething over the Republican refusal to even consider Merrick Garland, the nominee put forward by former President Obama. They're also concerned with the long-term shift to the right that Gorsuch would bring. They have pulled together enough votes to filibuster his nomination. The ultra-conservative Gorsuch is seen as a disciple of the late Associate Justice Antonin Scalia, the man he would be replacing. Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley is an especially vocal opponent of Judge Gorsuch, and he took the floor early to share his concerns. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has this report.
In a throwback to earlier times, Oregon Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley spoke against Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court for more than 15 hours overnight. Merkley has been a vocal opponent of Gorsuch's nomination, predicting as early as late January that his party would filibuster Trump's pick. During the old-style filibuster, which began just before 7 p.m. on Tuesday evening and ran until 10:15 this morning, Merkley laid out a broad criticism of the current Supreme Court, accused the Republicans of court packing, and leveled serious criticism against Judge Gorsuch's previous decisions and his evident lack of support for Roe v. Wade.
Judge Gorsuch's dissents from his colleagues on the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals are consistently right-wing, generally seeking to favor big business and other authority and harm the interests of workers and those who have suffered abuse by government officials. Encompass Environmental, Inc. versus the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission, Gorsuch dissented from a decision to affirm a Department of Labor fine against a company that failed to properly train a worker, resulting in his death by electrocution. Gorsuch has declined to discuss his views on Roe at his hearing, beyond acknowledging that it is precedent. But his writings make his position clear. Gorsuch has argued against the legal principles on which Roe is founded, both indirectly in his opinions and more directly in his book criticizing assisted suicide.
Merkley also referenced the cloud hanging over the Trump administration and questioned the legitimacy of a lifetime appointment by a president who is probably in ethical hot water.
And speaking of the president, it's unacceptable that we're considering this nomination at this moment when the Trump campaign is under investigation. Investigation being conducted by the FBI, another investigation by the House Intelligence Committee, another investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee. Unacceptable that we're considering this nomination at this moment when there is a cloud over the presidency.
Merkley's speech came as the Senate formally kicked off debate on Gorsuch's nomination Tuesday. However, it may not make any difference. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, filed cloture on Tuesday before Merkley even started speaking, setting up an automatic procedural vote for Thursday morning. At that time, if the Democrats attempt to filibuster the Gorsuch debate, it is expected that Senate Republicans will invoke what has been referred to as the nuclear option, a change in Senate rules that will allow Gorsuch's nomination to be approved by a simple majority. If the rule change is made, Republicans can approve the next Supreme Court judge without a single Democratic vote. But Merkley appeared undeterred by the deadline, with his office pledging that he would hold the floor and refuse to yield for as long as he was able to continue speaking. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Multnomah County health officials are investigating two cases of hepatitis A among workers at a pair of cup and saucer cafes. People who ate or drank at the cafe's Kenton location between February 22nd and March 29th are advised to get in touch with their health care provider, as are customers who are at the Hawthorne location on March 22nd or 25th. Hepatitis A is a contagious liver disease that can be a mild sickness, lasting a few weeks, or be more severe and last several months. Dr. Jennifer Vines, Multnomah County Deputy Health Officer, said, "We consider the risk to be relatively low."
Oregon Democratic Representative Suzanne Bonamici is co-sponsoring a bill that would prevent Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents from making arrests or conducting interviews, searches, or surveillances at a number of specified locations. The bill, entitled the Protecting Sensitive Locations Act, would turn many of ICE's pre-existing guidelines into law and add still more. Currently, ICE policy categorizes places of worship, schools, hospitals, funerals, weddings, and public rallies as, quote, sensitive locations, unquote, and recommends limiting ICE presence. The bill would ban ICE activity at those locations and expand the list to also include bus stops for children, offices for public assistance and members of Congress, and perhaps most prominently, all federal, state, and local courthouses. Bonamici sponsored the bill with Democratic Representatives Adriana Espaillat of New York, Jose Serrano of New York, and Don Beyer of Virginia. Since its introduction, at least 20 other co-sponsors have signed on. The bill was introduced during the same week that 84 people were detained by immigration agents in Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. Raids in or near courthouses by ICE agents have been reported in at least 5 states, including Arizona, California, Colorado, Oregon, and Texas. During a roundtable discussion on the bill, Bonamici said, quote, "Our communities are better and safer if all residents feel secure when accessing justice, seeking education and health care, or practicing their faith. Recent ICE action targeting immigrants has been aggressive and mean-spirited, and it does not improve the safety of our communities." Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Homeland Security Director John F. Kelly are strongly opposed to the bill, which is not expected to pass the Republican-controlled House.
The governors of the first four states to legalize recreational marijuana have sent an open letter urging the Trump administration to work with them before making any changes to the enforcement of federal drug laws in their states. The governors of Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Alaska yesterday addressed a letter to Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin asking the Trump administration to, quote, "engage with us before embarking on any changes to regulatory and enforcement systems related to recreational marijuana use." According to a recent Quinnipiac poll, 71% of Americans said they would oppose a federal crackdown on legal marijuana. Sessions and the White House have been sending mixed signals on their approach to the country's growing cannabis industry. In January, the Attorney General told some members of the Senate that he would respect state laws and not change federal policy. But in late February, he told reporters that the Obama-era pot policy was under review.
Portland Public Schools Interim Superintendent Bob McKean presented his proposed 2017-2018 budget at the school board's regular meeting on Tuesday night. The $616 million general fund budget proposes significant staffing cuts in the district's central office and in classrooms across the city. Portland's K-12 schools will lose 83 full-time teaching positions. The majority of the losses will be felt in the city's 10 high schools, which will lose 47 full-time teachers and see class size increases by an average of 2 students. In addition to staffing cuts, the budget reduces required school library openings from full week to half week. McKean said the cuts were necessary to close the district's $23 million budget deficit and to allow funds to be reallocated to improving educational equity through community engagement projects, expanding reading and writing programs, and increasing student health and safety by adding custodial staff, and if there is additional funding, removing lead from schools. The board has scheduled 3 listening sessions to hear public comments on the proposed budget before their work session on May 23rd. For more information, see the Portland Public Schools website, www.pps.net.
Earlier this week, California's Senate passed a so-called sanctuary state bill that would prevent local and state police from using their resources to enforce federal immigration laws. On a local level, Los Angeles is taking up the long-stalled issue of legalizing street vending. According to one count, as many as 50,000 people sell food on the city's streets. But in the era of the Trump administration, selling a bacon-wrapped hot dog could mean much more than a fine or getting your food cart confiscated. It could mean deportation for the many undocumented immigrants who can find no other work. FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports that this is one of the reasons that the LA City Council has put legalizing street vending on the fast track.
Placid pinkish beige strips of pigskin sizzle as they sink into a vat of oil, where they transform into bumpy, crunchy chicharrones, or pork rinds in English. They are a specialty for a Los Angeles street vendor named Enrique, and his are so popular the customers who line up to buy the popular snack call him the king of chicharrones. Enrique is one of as many as 50,000 street vendors in Los Angeles who sell everything from chicharrones to caps, from tacos to mangoes, from pineapples to pupusas. Street vending has a long tradition in Los Angeles, but it has not been legal. Yet it is often the only kind of work available to undocumented immigrants. After many unsuccessful years of trying to legalize street vending in L.A., the Trump administration's aggressive deportation efforts have given a sense of urgency to the long-delayed issue. Earlier this year, the L.A. City Council voted to at least decriminalize street vending, in part because undocumented immigrants could be deported for nothing more than getting busted for selling crispy pork rinds or the popular street staple, bacon-wrapped hot dogs. Enrique welcomes the idea of being able to legally sell his chicharrones.
It's a good thing because more people are going to start coming. Now people won't be scared to bring out their business, and it's going to generate more people to come to more sell.
Enrique works alongside his wife of 36 years, Estella, who is known for her Toluca-style chorizos. She's grown weary of the risks, including equipment seizures and fines that she's faced of up to $700 per incident.
You can see that she feels like anxiety because she can't do anything about it.
We cannot put in peril large amounts of members of our community and subject them to possible deportation with this policy.
L.A. City Councilman Gil Cedillo describes the situation of street vendors as a crisis best addressed with retroactive amnesty and forward-looking accountability mechanisms.
We have a need for some regulatory scheme, and we should construct that. We should do so in a thoughtful way, and you have made big steps forward. But at this very moment, when our nation is encumbered by recklessness, coming out of the White House and out of Washington, D.C., we must do all that we can to protect community.
But some members of the community at large feel their interests are falling by the wayside in the rush to green light. Jerry Agas helped put together a community impact statement regarding street vending for his neighborhood council in the San Fernando Valley.
How many streets in the San Fernando Valley, are wide enough to accommodate the above? Sidewalks in Sun Valley are designed for two people walking side by side, not for commerce.
There's also the question about who will be at the head of the line for permits.
Are permits awarded based on citizenship? Citizens versus non-citizens? Green cards versus undocumented?
A major criticism of legalizing street vendors is that they will have an unfair advantage over brick-and-mortar businesses. One proposed solution is to limit street vendors to only two per block, pending the permission of adjacent businesses. Merced Sanchez, who became a street vendor after her storefront burned down, says that's too limiting.
In the area where I am currently a street vendor, and that's the area where the piñatas are sold, we're currently 60 street vendors.
La mayoría nos quedaríamos sin trabajo. Además,
so if that happens and you only approve two street vendors per block, then the majority of us are going to stay without.
Que si ustedes permiten que los dueños de negocios nos pidan, le pidamos permiso.
We're going to stay without our business.
Even though the council has approved the framework for legalization, the details of how to enforce and regulate LA street vendors are being hashed out at the city attorney's office. In the meantime, lines continue to form in front of Enrique's food stand. Without prompting, he offers that he and his wife have never been on government assistance and that he's never committed any crimes, contrary to a statement made by the current president, who when campaigning said that many undocumented Mexicans were criminals, drug dealers, and rapists.
Eso dice Trump. Yo puedo decir que todos los gringos son drogadictos. Sí. A ver, dile, díselo, díselo.
He can easily say that. All white people, they're like crazy and...
Yeah. And drugs?
Yeah, they're drug addicts too.
And despite of his reputation as the king of chicharrones, Enrique seems less proud of his signature snack than he is of his daughter's university education.
University in the United States.
A dream made possible, he says, because he sells pork rinds on the streets of Los Angeles. Lena knows his way. FSRN, Los Angeles.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Kitchen Table Conversations at 6 o'clock. At 7, it will be Keeping It Real. Tomorrow's weather for Portland should be rainy with a high around 60 degrees and a low of 45. In Hood River, you can expect the exact same thing. Today in history, in 1994, grunge pioneer and Nirvana lead singer Kurt Cobain committed suicide, allegedly, in his Seattle home. The body was discovered 3 days later by an electrician installing a security system. Our quote for today is from Cobain. In the insecticide liner notes, he said, "At this point, I have a request for our fans. If any of you in any way hate homosexuals, people of different color, or women, please do us this one favor. Leave us the bleep alone."
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is ruminating on the American dream.
The American dream. They call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it, George Carlin said. America, I've given you all and now I'm nothing, Ginsberg wrote. The dream of being happier than your parents. King's dream. A world without prejudice and hate. A world of equal opportunity. A world where opposing war doesn't get you shot. And Langston Hughes, who wrote, "It never was America to me," and what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? Don't defer your dreams. Don't dream, act. No is not enough. I hope now isn't too late. For poetic justice and hope, this is Dan Raphael.
In some ways, the Trump administration is like Oregon weather, constantly changing back and forth. In its most recent flip-flop, Trump signed an executive order that removes his political strategist, Steve Bannon, from the National Security Council. The order also restores the traditional roles of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of national intelligence to the NSC. The change is seen as a victory for Trump's second national security advisor, Army Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, who replaced Michael Flynn. The Strategic Initiatives Group, a parallel security structure outside the White House, reports to Bannon.
It's Wednesday, and that can only mean one thing. Daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Question. What do you get when you mix a barrel of fables, a sack of mendacity, and a gross of whoppers, topped with a thick layer of subterfuge? Answer. The fiasco called Trump Care. We're going to do something that's great, the Donald Trumpeted when he endorsed House Speaker Paul Ryan's bill to displace Obamacare. But Trump Care was great only in the sense that it was a great big bloated concoction of lies. Start with the original lie that right-wing Republicans have harped on for nearly a decade. Obamacare is a total failure. We'll, quote, repeal and replace it as soon as we get control of the national government, they shouted. Then, when Trump happened, he made killing Obama's Affordable Care Act his top legislative priority. Ryan chimed in with a perfect imitation of Chicken Little, squawking that the ACA is in a, quote, death spiral. In fact, the president and the speaker were lying. While Obamacare has flaws that require fixing, overall, it's been a tremendous success. It has reduced by almost half the number of Americans who had no health coverage, benefiting especially many white working-class people who had supported Trump. Moreover, the overwhelming majority of the millions who gained ACA coverage are satisfied and glad to have it. Undeterred, the Trumpsters tried another Chicken Little tale. The health law is doomed, they squawk, because it's been unprofitable for the insurance giants, so they're withdrawing. Bogus! In fact, the profits of Aetna, Cigna, Humana, United Health, and other managed care corporations have soared under Obamacare. The biggest one, United Health, has seen the value of its shares skyrocket by a spectacular 480% since the ACA expansion of Medicaid. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why Trump is so hostile to truth-based news. Actual facts exposed his lies.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
If Miko Vegan is any indication, our future is in good hands. The 15-year-old Portlander is a climate activist and advocate for the Marshall Islands, and will soon be making a presentation on climate change in Washington, D.C. KBOO's Zelis Marchant had a chance to speak with a future leader.
I have with me Miko Vegan,
from the Marshall Islands talking about the nuclear testing that has happened there for about 12 years. Miko, thank you very much for taking time to come to our station and talk to us. Can you tell our audience about yourself, like how you've come to do a recent talk that you did on April 1st?
So basically, I've been doing stuff involving the Marshall Islands and climate activism for a long time, basically since my bat mitzvah, which is basically a bar mitzvah but for girls, and it's the coming of age for a Jewish woman. And basically, what you're supposed to do for your bat or bar mitzvah project is basically a mitzvah project, which is a good deeds project. And I chose to do something about getting a community center and solar panels in the Marshall Islands in case of typhoons and stronger storms because of climate change, and a place people could go there in case of that. And ever since that, I've been engaging in more climate activism stuff. For example, after my bat mitzvah project, I went to an academy for Plant for the Planet, which is a UN-sponsored organization that holds one-day academies for kids and teaches them about climate change and works on their public speaking skills so they can go to rallies and marches and talk to state representatives and other people who are making decisions that may affect our future. And I decided to incorporate what I learned from that and do more climate activism stuff and basically take advantage of that and speak about the Marshall Islands and how it is also affected by climate change and also the nuclear testing that happened after World War II.
And what kind of effects have taken place on the islands?
Well, basically, because of the nuclear testing, some islands were vaporized, and so they exist, but they are no longer inhabitable, and people can't live on them. And basically, a lot of the fish and stuff, which is a main resource for the Marshall Islands, because it's mainly a fishing culture. They can't eat it, so they're mostly eating imported goods and stuff that aren't healthy. And also, before the nuclear testing, land was passed down from generation to generation, and it was also matrilineal, so it was passed down from women. And basically, because of the nuclear testing, that has affected that tradition, because a lot of the land is not inhabitable, so they can't pass that land down. And also the role of women has been taken away as well. And now that climate change has entered the picture and stuff, a lot of islands are getting smaller and smaller and smaller because of coastal erosion, and now people have to leave and stuff, and droughts and floods have come in and stuff, and yeah.
That is a lot to process. With the importing situation, what kind of food is getting imported if fishing is no longer a reliable resource for your culture?
Well, I know that I don't really know what basically obesity is a huge problem in the Marshall Islands and stuff, and a lot of the food that they're consuming is not healthy for them. And for after the nuclear testing, soldiers gave the people pork, and they're a fishing culture. They come from a fishing culture, so they didn't really know what to do with the pork, and they didn't know how to cook it or anything, and so they were just left starving for a while.
So they just dropped off pork and said good luck.
Yeah.
Figuring out how to cut this and make this into something that tastes delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. I understand you have family there still. How are they doing?
I don't really talk to them.
Okay. Wasn't sure if it was a situation where you were adopted, but you still had contact.
I still have contact with them. I just don't really hear from them that much and they sound like they're doing pretty well.
They're doing okay. That's good to know. Could you tell our listeners more about the history, the current situation? Is there any signs of, I don't even know where to go from here, any signs of rehabilitation? It sounds like most of the islands are, or the island is vaporized. You know, any signs of helping the fishing production get any better?
At this point, the fishing production can't get any better because the radiation is in the water, and that's something that can't be taken out or anything. And basically, people can't, one island in particular, or atoll, is Bikini Atoll, where basically they tested a whole bunch of hydrogen bombs on there, and people cannot move back. And so this year actually marks 71 years that the Bikinians can't go back, and they probably won't ever actually go back because it's so polluted, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I'm itching to know, in the wake of your culture being matrilineal and not having something to pass down, how that has changed social structures. Is it still matrilineal, and how are those indigenous to the Marshall Islands able to adapt?
Well, land it still is very sacred to the Marshallese, but I don't think it represents any, like, basically before it was supposed to be something special where a mom would pass it down to the next generation of women, and basically now it's just basically just land. And now that climate change has happened and the nuclear radiation has affected it, it doesn't have the same special type of thing to it. And basically women also don't have the same roles as they did before, as I said before. But basically there was a huge problem in the Marshall Islands about domestic violence and stuff, and I don't know if that's a huge problem now, but I remember in sixth grade researching about it, and it was definitely a problem there.
Mm. So you chose this specific project because you came from there and it spoke to you. Did you have other Marshallese experiences or friends, or obviously you still kept in contact with your family. Mm-hmm. Did any of that inspire you beyond the obvious atrocities?
Well, I was actually inspired to do this project last spring, actually. We were supposed to come up with a personal project, which this actually ended up being my personal project, for our sophomore year, which is a huge thing that we have to do. And I was still kind of looking for something to do, but I knew I wanted to do something about talking about the Marshall Islands because it's the place where I was born, so I wanted to do something special about it. And May is when May Day happens, and that's a huge thing. That's a huge thing for the Marshall Island, for the Marshallese, because it is basically the Independence Day and Constitution Day for the Marshallese. And so everyone gets together, and there's like food and activities. And last year, it was mostly about the nuclear legacy. And I heard Dr. Holly Barker talk about her stay in the Marshall Islands, and she talked about the people she met and what she learned. And a bunch of what she talked about was the nuclear legacy. And I was really inspired, and I chose that to be my personal project because I knew about it before, but I didn't really know what happened and why it happened, like the severity of it and how horrific it was, until I learned about it. And so I was like, I need to do this. So that's why I chose it for my project.
So it sounds like when there was a proposal to do nuclear testing, the Marshallese was not included in pertinent need to know information,
yeah,
such as this will wipe out the ability for your land to produce fish and grow things and for humans to to habitat to be on the islands. Was there anything in those proposals that addressed the fact that there would be displacement issues?
Not really. Basically, they were just told, okay, we're going to evacuate you from this island and move you into this island. And actually, as this was happening, later on, though, not the tests weren't done yet, but later on, though, the Marshallese came up with a petition and basically said, we don't want you to harm our islands anymore. And basically, land is very sacred to us. And we'd like it if you not destroy it. And it took 4 years for the UN to consider it, because basically the Secretary General or whatever told the head of the UN, I think, basically not to present it to the UN. And basically it didn't get considered until 4 years later.
It took 4 years before it to go before the UN.
Yeah, and after that, it was basically too late. And then the Marshallese just, like, were left powerless and watched their land being destroyed.
So the U.S. is still there in some way?
The U.S. isn't there, but the legacy is definitely there. For example, the U.S., after the testing, decided that they didn't want to clean up their mess, so they dumped a whole bunch of nuclear waste onto one island and put cement on top of it. And it's called Runet Dome, and it's on Runet Island. And basically left anything else to the Marshallese government and said it was their responsibility.
So and they literally built the dome and then checked out.
Yeah. And basically the problem is with that, because of rising sea levels, that is basically there's a higher chance that the dome will start leaking, and there's 111,000 cubic yards of debris in there, and it'll go into the Pacific Ocean.
And it's just a wonderful good deed that you are doing, spreading this information that affects a lot of people, and it's heartbreaking that it is really torn a rift in your people's way of life and history. How can anybody get in contact with you about this going forward?
Well, they can just email my mom at her email, which is vergun@alumni.stanford.edu.
Okay. I also believe there's a website. Is it the climatechangerecovery.org website?
Yeah.
That's to find out more information, right?
Yeah, and that's also for signing up for academies. So if you're interested or anything and you know any kids or anything, you can get them signed up.
Kids who want to do amazing things like stop nuclear waste, that's the spot for you. Climatechangerecovery.org. Great. Well, Miko Vergun, thank you so much for talking to us and our audience about the nuclear history in the Marshall Islands. It means a lot to us.
Thank you.
It was KBOO's Zales Marchant speaking with 15-year-old Miko Vergun about climate change and the Marshall Islands.
Score one for equality. The U.S. Appeals Court's Seventh Circuit ruled today that LGBTQ people cannot be fired for their sexual orientation on the grounds that it violates the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Kimberly Hively, the plaintiff in the case, claims she was denied a full-time position at Ivy Tech Community College in South Bend, Indiana, because she was a lesbian. Although the Civil Rights Act does not explicitly block discrimination on the basis of sexuality, it does prohibit it on the basis of gender, and the court found that Hively was passed over because of gender prejudice. Greg Nevins of Lambda Legal, an advocate for LGBTQ rights, said, quote, "This decision is a game changer for lesbian and gay employees facing discrimination in the workplace and sends a clear message to employers." However, the Seventh Circuit's decision conflicts with a decision last month by the 11th Circuit, which found in a separate case that the Civil Rights Act did not protect sexual orientation. This split in the circuits could elevate the case to the Supreme Court.
The Trump administration says it's cutting off U.S. funding to the United Nations Population Fund, the Agency for Reproductive Health, because it supports a Chinese program that uses forced abortions. The fund, which offers aid to more than 150 countries, is expected to lose $32.5 million in the 2017 budget, according to an Associated Press report on Monday. The State Department said those funds will instead be shifted to similar programs at the U.S. Agency for International Development. The administration said it does not want the funds to go to China's government to support population controls or for coercive abortions under its two-child policy, despite the fact that there is, unsurprisingly, no evidence of UN support for forced abortions or sterilizations in China. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee was reportedly notified of the State Department's decision in a letter on Monday, in which State Department Undersecretary of Political Affairs Tom Shannon said that the fund supports or participates in the management of a program of coercive abortion or involuntary sterilization. It's not unusual for Republican presidents to cut off funds to the UN Population Fund. It has been more than once cut by Republican presidents and later restored by Democratic presidents. The UN Population Fund, or UNFPA, said it regretted the U.S. move, adding that it is erroneous to suggest that it is complicit in China's policies.
In what may be the most deadly incident so far in the Syrian conflict, over 60 people were killed and hundreds injured by two separate chemical weapons attacks in the rebel-controlled northern province of Idlib. Toxic gas was dropped over the village of Khan Shikun, where there are thousands of refugees from a nearby province. A second bombardment later in the day targeted a hospital with poison gas. Around a third of the casualties were children. Doctors say the symptoms shown by victims are consistent with the use of nerve agents such as sarin. International treaty bans the use of nerve agents as well as attacks on hospitals. In reaction to the assault, the United Nations Security Council called an emergency meeting today where U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley threatened that the U.S. would take unilateral action if the U.N. did not respond quickly. But Haley also acknowledged, quote, "We don't yet know everything about yesterday's attack." Holding pictures of some of yesterday's victims, she said, quote, "How many more children have to die before Russia cares?"
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. IAM International President Robert Martinez Jr. says Trump should take bold action to defend North American workers from China's unfair trade policies. Martinez says when Trump meets with a Chinese president, the IAM hopes Trump will stand for good jobs and simple trade justice. Martinez says it's time to bring U.S. jobs home. The IAM says that the blame for loss of U.S. manufacturing jobs lies not just with China, but with companies like Boeing, who are happy to ship U.S. jobs overseas. Martinez says our politicians have been too quiet for too long on job losses from trade deals, and working people have had enough lip service. He says U.S. corporations that have sent jobs abroad need to take immediate action to bring the work home. The April 4th Fight for 15 Black Lives Movement protests by thousands of low-paid workers in 30 cities is the kickoff of a wave of worker protests. Leading up to big worker strike actions on May 1st, there will be a wave of worker actions. Workers, clergy, and other supporters marking the 40th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination on Tuesday demanded $15 in a union, tying that protest to civil rights. In Detroit, Pastor W.J. Rideout III helped make these worker voices for economic and social justice heard as he reminded them that Dr. King was killed standing in solidarity with striking Memphis sanitation workers.
All of these corporations that are not paying people $15 an hour and not allowing them to unionize, we came to let them know that we are fed up and we're not going to take it no more.
SEIU President Mary Kay Henry said that underpaid workers across the country carry forward Dr. King's legacy of fighting for an America where all work is valued and all people are respected. She vowed to continue organizing and said it won't stop until, quote, "our wages match the value of our work and all families and communities can thrive." SEIU says the Fight for 15 has spurred wage hikes for 22 million underpaid workers, including more than 10 million who are on their way to $15 an hour, by convincing everyone from voters to politicians to corporations to raise worker pay. The Communications Workers of America have won a labor complaint that will force T-Mobile to disband its fake company union. NLRB Judge Sharon Levinson-Steckler ruled that T-Voice must be disbanded. In her decision, she said whenever an employer unlawfully establishes and maintains a dominated labor organization, that organization must be disestablished. These fake company unions, like the one used at T-Mobile, have been against national labor law since the 1930s. Wynn is brought to you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jasmine Moneymaker, Tom Flynn, Dan Raphael, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Zalos Marchand. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zalos Marchand, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with host Joanne Hardesty, Progressive Talk Radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, the news you are not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, the truth behind the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., according to the book, The Plot to Kill King. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it'll be Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, author Otessa Moshfig talks about her critically acclaimed short story collection, Homesick for Another World. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk features interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Welcome to News from the Boo, your weekly program about what is going on with your community radio station. I'm your host this evening, Delphine Crescenzo. Today, we talk about community resilience and how we build community health and wealth together with KBOO volunteer and executive director for